Friday, May 1st, and welcome to CREA 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. President EJ Myung marked Labour Day by urging Labour and management to move beyond confrontation. More on that in News Briefing. On In Depth, we look at the conditions facing South Korea's migrant workers, from unsafe housing and poor workplaces to recent abuse cases that have sparked national concern. In a special interview, we speak with Goyang Sono Sky Gunners Centre, Nathan Knight, about the team's turnaround, adapting to Korean basketball and the title series ahead. And on Movie Spotlight, our critics join us all the way from Udine, Italy, for the Far East Film Festival. Let's start CREA 24 right now.
Dear 국민 여러분, 그리고 세상을 움직이는 자랑스러운 이름 노동자 여러분.
President Lee Jae-myung marked Labor Day by hosting a ceremony at Cheonghwa-dae on Friday, the first time the event was held at the presidential compound. He pledged to enhance workplace safety and create a society that respects labor, vowing to make no compromises in protecting workers. To tell us more about his remarks, as well as some of the other headlines of the day, we have now with us in the studio our KBS World News editor, Koo Hee-jin. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Alana.
Hee-jin, this year's Labor Day coincided with its return as a legal public holiday for the first time in 63 years. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about the ceremony?
Well, speaking at the event, President Lee Jae-myung shared that he himself had worked as a child laborer and pledged to build a country where everyone can work safely and where labor is respected, and that there will be no compromise when it comes to workplace safety. The president placed particular emphasis on labor management cooperation, stating that there are no workers without companies and no companies without workers. Let's listen to what he had to say.
친노동은 반기업, 친기업은 반노동이라는 이
We can only move forward by breaking free from the outdated belief that being pro-business means being anti-labor. I will build an ecosystem of coexistence in which labor and management can respect one another and engage in dialogue.
Now, the president's remarks come as a major labor union at Samsung Electronics has threatened an 18-day general strike starting May 21st, demanding higher bonuses in line with the company's record-high revenue. Mm-hmm. The collective action could result in operating losses in the tens of trillions of won.
Well, the head of that labor union reportedly claimed that the president's warning was aimed at LGU Plus rather than their own union. In his speech on Friday, President Lee urged both labor and management not to turn on each other or view one another as adversaries despite their differences. Lee said he would deliver what he called real growth driven by a virtuous cycle of cooperation between labor and business, fairness and cooperation, and growth and equitable distribution. The president also vowed to uphold the value of labor in the face of advancing artificial intelligence and to expand fundamental labor rights.
I understand that representatives from both management and labor unions, along with relevant ministries, attended the event in full force.
That's right. It brought together some 130 participants from labor, management and government, including the heads of the Federation of Korean Trade Unions and the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions, as well as the chairman of the Korea Enterprises Federation. The leaders of the two umbrella labor groups called on the government to guarantee labor rights amid the growing presence of artificial intelligence and deepening inequality. The 1st of May has long been observed in South Korea as a day for workers, although it was renamed Workers' Day in 1963. The original designation of Labor Day was restored last year. The government made it a national holiday for all workers earlier this year, allowing for all workers to take the day off.
Well, speaking of businesses, let's now take a look at our monthly trade figures. Exports in April expanded nearly 50% from last year on the back of an ongoing
ongoing supercycle in semiconductors, with shipments surpassing $80 billion for 2 months in a row for the very first time. Heejin, can you break down the figures for us?
Well, according to data from the Ministry of Trade, Industry and Resources on Friday, exports rose 48% year on year to an April record of $85.89 billion. Chip shipments led to the gains, jumping 173.5% to $31.9 billion in April, the second highest monthly amount to date. On the other hand, auto exports dropped 5.5% to $6.17 billion amid persisting shipping disruptions stemming from the Middle East crisis and the impact of U.S. tariffs.
Now, in other news, South Korea's top diplomat at the United Nations has urged North Korea to fulfill its obligations under the Treaty of the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, stressing Seoul's firm resolve toward denuclearization and peaceful coexistence on the Korean Peninsula. What can you tell us about the discussions at the UN?
Well, a UN Security Council session on non-proliferation on Thursday, Cha Ji-hoon, head of South Korea's permanent mission to the UN, reiterated Seoul's opposition to recognizing North Korea as a nuclear-armed state during the ongoing NPT review process. He warned that abandoning the goal of denuclearization would have serious negative consequences for non-proliferation efforts, not only in the region, but also worldwide.
In other headlines, police have arrested and repatriated a South Korean man from Thailand for allegedly supplying narcotics to the extradited murderer and drug lord Park Kwang-yeol. Heejin, can you tell us more about the suspect?
Well, the man in his 50s, identified only by his surname Che, arrived at Incheon International Airport on Friday morning. He's expected to face police interrogation for violating the Narcotics Control Act. Che is known on Telegram as Cheongdam and is accused of smuggling and distributing approximately 22 kilograms of methamphetamine and other narcotics worth about 10 billion won or around 6.8 million US dollars in South Korea since 2019. The Gyeonggi Namdo Provincial Police, leading the investigation, confirmed that Che was staying in the Thai province of Samut Prakan, about an hour's drive from Bangkok, and that he was apprehended on the 10th of April for illegal residency with the help of the Thai police cooperation. The South Korean authorities plan to look into allegations of Park and Che's collusion, drug crimes and violation of the Passport Act.
For our listeners planning overseas trips anytime soon, they may be set to see a jump in airline ticket prices. Fuel surcharges on international flights issued for May will double in amount compared to April in the wake of the prolonged crisis in the Middle East. Heejin, what exactly can we expect?
Well, according to aviation industry sources on Friday, the highest level on the 33-point scale for the fuel surcharge standard will be applied for the first time starting the 1st of May, up 15 notches from April. Flagship carrier Korean Air has raised its one-way fuel surcharge for May to between 75,000 won and 564,000 won, or around 51 to 382 US dollars, compared with April surcharges, which ranged between 42,000 won and 303,000 won.
And that's where we'll wrap up today's news briefing. Thanks so much, Heejin, for bringing us all the headlines.
Thank you.
South Korea depends heavily on its 1.1 million migrant workers, but many continue to face poor working conditions, unsafe housing, and serious abuse.
In recent months, several disturbing cases have drawn national attention, including a Sri Lankan worker who was wrapped in plastic, tied to a pallet of bricks and lifted by a forklift, and a Thai worker who was severely injured in an alleged workplace assault involving an industrial air gun. With today being Labour Day, we're taking a closer look at the conditions migrant workers face, why abuses continue, and what needs to change. To discuss this, we're joined today in the studio by three guests. First, we have Korea Times reporter Lee Hyo-jin, who has been closely covering this issue. Thanks for joining us, Ms. Lee.
Yes, hello, thank you for having me.
We also have Sheikh Al-Mamoon, a naturalised Korean from Bangladesh and deputy chief of the Migrants Trade Union under the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions. Welcome to the show, Mr. Sheikh Al-Mamoon.
Hello.
And from the Korea Confederation of Trade Unions, or KCTU, is Ryu Mi-kyung, head of the union's international department. Hello, Ms. Ryu.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, before we talk about the broader conditions and the recent abuse cases, I'd like to start with your own experience, Mr. Sheikh Al-Mamoon, because you've lived this issue not only as a migrant worker, but also as a labour activist. Could you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Actually, I am from Bangladesh in 1998 in Korea, and I got married 2004, and I applied the citizen, and then 2009 I get the citizenship. Actually, I am first when I come in Korea, I work in the furniture factory in Namyeongju, and that time I experienced many discrimination and did not receive my welfare. At that time, my Bangladeshi friend actually introduced Equality Trade Union, and that time the Equality Trade Union helped me to take my money. And then one day I go to the union office, and then I say, I do some things for you. Actually, that time the guy said me, I don't need any things, but I wish you come, one day you come our rally. So at first I go in there, and then some people, they are shouting, their migrant workers are shouting in there, and they, I remember they are make a song, and the lyrics is saying this, even if I live one day, I want to live like a human being. Mm. At that time, I think that I have no human being in Korea, so I joined the trade union, Equality Trade Union, mm-hmm. and then now I am do my best in the migrant trade union MTU.
Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, you had those own experiences firsthand, and then decided to join the trade union. Based on your work with the migrants trade union, Mr. Sheikh Al-Mamoon, and the people you speak with, how would you describe the working conditions for migrant workers in South Korea today?
Actually, migrant workers have very hard working condition. Those jobs are called three jobs, dirty, difficult and dangerous. Now people also say it's 4D, it means plus die. So migrant workers face more unpaid workplace and more workplace debt than Korean workers, about 2 to 3 times more. Mm-hmm. They also experience harassment and violence. They suffer both dangerous work and discrimination.
Mm-hmm. Before we delve further, Ms. Lee, I'd like to turn to you now. You've been covering this topic. Could you summarise the recent controversial cases of human rights abuses of foreign workers in Korea?
Sure. Thank you for the question. As you mentioned, there have been several shocking cases recently that really put migrant workers' conditions in the spotlight. I think one of the most serious incidents happened earlier this year in February at a plating factory in Hwaseong, Gyeonggi Province. So a factory owner in his 60s used an industrial air gun on a Thai worker's anal area, which caused severe injuries that required surgery. And the victim is still undergoing treatment. The employer claimed that it was just a prank, and he said that he had no intention to harm the victim, but the authorities are investigating it as aggravated assault. And earlier this week, a court issued an arrest warrant against the employer, and the investigations are still ongoing. And another widely circulated case took place last year at a brick factory in Naju, South Jeolla Province. a Sri Lankan worker was bound with plastic wrap to a pallet of bricks and lifted up into the air by a forklift by a Korean colleague. And this video spread online, and it sparked public outrage. So the worker suffered significant psychological trauma, and he had to receive support from migrant support groups, and he has been relocated to another workplace. And the forklift driver, the Korean colleague, is currently standing trial on charges of labor law violations, and the prosecutors recently sought a one-year sentence against him.
You've described there two incidents. Is this more of a widespread problem?
Yes, I think these are just two of the most visible cases, mm-hmm. but they kind of point to a broader pattern that many foreign workers in Korea continue to face not only physical abuse, but also structural vulnerabilities in the workplace.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes without saying that these cases that you've just described are absolutely shocking. I think those conditions, though, they might come as a bit of a surprise to some of our listeners, especially given South Korea's kind of global image as a cultural and economic success story. Ms. Ryu, from your work with the KCTU's international department, how do international labour organisations and activists view migrant workers' conditions in South Korea? And what kind of concerns do they raise when they hear about the cases like the ones that we've just heard?
Yeah, actually, South Korea is a major destination for migrant workers in Asia. And when people look at working conditions of migrant workers, they compare it with Singapore, Hong Kong, Japan, and the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And the employment permit system is generally viewed positively because it's based on government-to-government agreement. That means fewer labor workers involved, which reduce one significant source of exploitation. But when international labor organizations find puzzling is that despite this system, discrimination, harassment, and exploitation of migrant workers still happen regularly. So they ask, what's the actual gap in the system and what structural problems in Korean society allow this to continue? And Korea has ratified the ILO Convention 111 on discrimination at work and the UN Convention on Elimination of Racial Discrimination. And in their supervisory mechanism, these international bodies have repeatedly recommended that Korean government should strengthen protection for migrant workers. But I must emphasize that the international labor movement, take note, is the role of trade union here. Mm-hmm. This is one area where Korea stands out compared to other major destination countries in Asia. When migrant workers organize themselves into union and raise their voices, it pushes the big organizations like KCTU to take more active action, and that creates real incremental change. The policy shift and public awareness also shift. It's very slow, but in Asia and Middle East, it's relatively rare to see this way of progress.
So what you're saying is that a lot of the change that's being called for is actually coming from the migrant workers themselves.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, beyond the shock of the individual cases, of course, there's the bigger question of why these problems keep happening. Mr. Sheikh Al-Mamoun, from your perspective, what do you think is causing these problems?
So the problem came from the unfair law and system. Under the employment permit system, migrant workers cannot freely quit their job without permission from their employer. Because on this, employer cannot say workers bodily control them easily. Similar problem exists in our migrant workers is big problem. Mm-hmm. That's why we say is system is like a first lever.
Mm-hmm. So basically workers are at the mercy of their employers and are unable to quit. And I imagine face conditions that they have to deal with because they're stuck at those jobs. I'd like to put the same question to you, Ms. Ryu. From the perspective of organised labour, what do you see as the causes behind these recurring problems for migrant workers in Korea?
Yes, I'd like to add on what Sheikh Al-Mamoun just elaborated. Recently, the Ministry of Employment and Labor held a discussion on this through a foreign workforce integration task force. There has been some movement toward relaxing the restriction on the right to change of workplaces. Mm-hmm. But the government's position is very clear. They can loosen the restriction somewhat, but they can't remove them completely. Their reason is that the objective of the EPS system is to fill labor shortage in small and medium enterprises that can't find Korean workers not to provide jobs to Korean workers, but not to provide jobs for foreigners. Mm-hmm. So in this situation, when migrant workers face unfair treatment, they have no leverage to protest or demand improvement. And there is another layer. Employment status and residency, the visa, are tied together. And if a worker leaves their job, they have to find a new one within a certain period. If they fail, their visa is automatically revoked. So until this vulnerable condition for migrant workers improve, the problem will persist.
So there's a lot at stake for migrant workers with those visas. Quitting a job means that they have to actually leave the country as well if they cannot find new employment. Ms. Lee, that brings us to the question of accountability, reform, what the state is doing when these abuses come to light and whether their response is enough. Ms. Lee, what is the government doing to improve the working conditions for migrant workers?
Well, first of all, for the two cases that we've mentioned, the government has started taking a number of steps to prevent such cases, both on the investigative side and in terms of policy. So for the Hwasong Aragon case, police are carrying out joint investigation with the Labor Ministry, and they're providing the victim with psychological counseling as well as medical treatment. And more broadly, the Justice Ministry says it will launch a dedicated task force to look into, to broadly look into migrant workers' rights violations in workplaces and factories, and strengthen oversight monitoring of workplaces that are employing these foreign workers across the country. And these steps come after President Lee Jae-myung publicly criticized both the brick factory and the air gun incident. He called these kind of violence and discrimination against migrant workers as a serious crime that cannot be tolerated, and ordered a broader review of these incidents. I think he personally has a lot of attention to these cases because he himself was a factory worker mm-hmm. when he was young. And during a meeting with senior aides on Tuesday, the president said there needs to be fundamental measures to prevent these incidents, such as providing human rights education on employers and stricter enforcement against violations of labor laws.
I mean, of course, always positive to hear that the government, it sounds like, is trying to take steps, and especially coming from the highest level, the president coming out and condemning these cases. But Ms. Ryu, what more do you think should be done to make Korea a better environment for these kinds of workers?
Yes, there are a few things that really need to happen. First is enforcement. Actually, there are around 60,000 workplaces under the EPS. And in 6 months, labor inspectors managed to visit maybe only 3,000 of them. So even when they find violation, most of the time they give a correction notice. That's all. No real consequences. And I believe that we need actual penalties that have dissuasive effects on the employer side. And secondly, the coverage of the Labor Standard Act is another problem. Most migrant workers are working in small workplaces, but the act has exemption for really small businesses with less than 5 permanent employees. So migrant workers end up with basically no legal protection. Mm-hmm. That should be changed. Thirdly, we need a comprehensive anti-discrimination law. There's nothing right now that explicitly bans discrimination based on race, nationality, migration status. So that's why migrant rights groups have demanded the legislation for a long time. and the UN has repeatedly recommended the Korean government to do so. Lastly, migrant workers also need real rights to form and join unions. One of the major obstacles for migrant workers to exercise these rights, even though the Korean Supreme Court confirmed that this should be guaranteed for all migrant workers, is short-term circulation system that make migrant workers consistently under threat. If workers can freely organize together, that's when things actually change.
Mm-hmm. And just for some context there for our listeners, EPS, which you just mentioned, is the employment permit system, which migrant workers, it's how they're allowed to work in South Korea. Now, Mr. Sheikh Al-Mamoun, I understand that you and other members of the Migrants Trade Union recently held a rally calling for improved working conditions. Can you tell our listeners what were your demands?
Actually, we have many demands, but the major demand is the now the workers, they have no choice, they have no rights to change their worker place. So it's a main problem that they are not change their worker place, our own. For that, sometimes they are the boss violence, but they not go another side. Mm-hmm. So we said that we granted our of the freedom of the change worker place, and also we said that there are many undocumented workers in here. We are like to stop the crackdown, and then they need to registration the undocumented workers. And we also say abolish the EPS, the employer permit system, and then make WPS is mean work permit system.
Mm-hmm.
So it's our major things, and many of them that the in Korea, the migrant workers, their housing problem is big problem.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
we are every time we are say ban the poor and temporarily housing. Yeah, it's all of them. And I think it's just one hour I say my demand is okay. So for that, is our major demand is now is free job change.
Right. So, of course, there are many layers to this issue. But the crux for you and for the union is the fact that migrant workers are unable to change their workplace without permission from their employer. Ms. Ryu, before we wrap up, I'd like to give everyone a chance to share any final thoughts. Ms. Ryu, I'll start with you. What is the most important point you want our listeners today to take away from the discussion?
Migrant workers come to Korea looking for better living conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But Korean society doesn't see them as human beings trying to build a decent life. It only cares about whether they are useful for the Korean society, whether they feel the workforce shortage. Because of that, migrant workers aren't treated as rights-bearing people. They are treated as objects to be controlled. So that's the fundamental thing that needs to change.
Mm-hmm. And Ms. Lee, what should we be watching for next when it comes to migrant workers' rights in South Korea?
I think the cases that we discussed today, they're only tip of the iceberg, and they point to a deeper structural problems that still need to be addressed through policies or legislation. But more importantly, as Ms. Ryu said, there has to be really a change of mindset among the employers that these workers, these foreign workers, are part of our society. And they need to work harder. I mean, the employers need to work harder to make workplaces more inclusive and respectful for migrant workers.
Mm-hmm. Well, as Korea marks Labor Day today, our conversation reminds us that the people helping sustain key parts of the economy also need stronger protection, safer workplaces and equal dignity on the job. And it also reminds us of the relationships already being built in communities across South Korea, where migrant workers are not only colleagues, but also neighbours and friends. That was Korea Times reporter Lee Ho-jin. Thank you so much for joining us, Miss E.
Thank you.
Sheikh Al-Mamoun of the Migrants Trade Union, thank you for joining us, Mr. Al-Mamoun.
Thank you.
And Rumi Gyeong of the KCTU, thank you for your insights, Ms.
Thank you so much.
The Goyang Sano Skygunners have made it to the Korean Basketball League Championship Finals for the very first time. The team has not only made history, but they've done it the hard way. After finishing the regular season in fifth place, Goyang earned their first ever playoff berth and then caught fire, going undefeated so far in the postseason. Now, the question is whether they can keep that remarkable run going and turn a breakthrough season into a championship. Today, in place of Korea Trending, we're joined by one of the players at the heart of that rise, American center Nathan Knight, whose performances have helped power Goyang's historic playoff push. Mr. Knight joins us now on the line. Welcome to Korea 24. It's great to have you with us.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, before we get into the big moments, the comeback, and of course, the finals ahead, we have to start with the obvious. This is a huge achievement. So I have to start with congratulations. Goyang are heading to the championship finals for the first time. Mr. Knight, has that just, you know, sunk in yet? How are you feeling right now?
No, it hasn't sunken in just yet. I think it will become a reality once game one starts. I'm extremely grateful, extremely happy to be here, extremely proud of, you know, the entire organization, my coaching staff, and my teammates. So, yeah, I'm just glad we're able to make it this far. I think that the biggest thing for me is that I get to continue to play basketball right now, which I'm most excited for. I think the dust will settle once game one starts.
Obviously, a huge personal achievement and a huge achievement for your team. I'd say one of the, you know, the biggest moments in that run came when Goyang knocked out the defending champions. You clinched that spot in the finals by beating the Changwon LG Sakers on Monday. What was the atmosphere like in the locker room after that game? And what do you remember most from those first few minutes with your teammates and your coaches?
Yeah, I mean, It was hard to not, you know, be excited. It was hard not to be happy, accomplishing what we were able to accomplish. LG is a very good organization, and they have a very well-run system with a lot of great players. So being able to win the way we did, was just, it made everybody feel really good. And we were all very, very excited to, you know, be in the position that we're in. But the coaching staff, the leaders on the team, wanted to remind everybody that the most important thing was to stay present. And yes, we made it to the finals, but that's exactly what it is. We just made it. We haven't won it yet. So the biggest thing was to, you know, just stay the course and, you know, enjoy the feeling and then be prepared to work to get ready for the finals.
Right. Of course, this is a huge accomplishment, but I did want to ask you, you know, do you actually get to celebrate, or is it, you know, just now there's time to focus even more?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, you feel good on what you just accomplished. Obviously, it's hard not to. So enjoy that feeling and, you know, be ready to work. That's what it was for us. Enjoy that feeling tonight, but understand that there's more work to be done.
So just one night of enjoyment and then back to hard work the next day. I think for our listeners maybe who are not so familiar with the Korean Basketball League, what makes this run even more remarkable is Goyang's season, it didn't always look like it was heading towards the finals. There are 10 teams in the KBL, and at one point during the regular season, you know, Goyang were all the way down in ninth place, but the team climbed all the way back up, finished fifth, and of course has now reached the championship finals. What factors do you think made it possible for Goyang to secure this coveted spot and climb all the way back up the table?
I think the biggest thing for us was just, you know, just trying to stay even keel. This is a 54-game season, and, you know, inside of that, each game is 40 minutes. And this sport, it's very imperfect. There's a lot of moving pieces. There's a lot of things that us as players can't control. And that was, you know, the biggest message that was given to us by the coaching staff. And the biggest thing that I tried to relay to my teammates as well is that it's not going to be perfect all the time. You want it to be. You train for it to be. But the biggest thing is, you know, just not letting the uncontrollables get in the way of what the ultimate goal is. And, you know, we were able to turn it around, you know, once we really grasped that concept. And we were able to, you know, remain a cohesive unit through all the turmoil that we went through this entire season.
Before that turnaround, and when Goyang was struggling and in the lower tier of the standings, did you have confidence that the team, you know, could climb it back up the table
and make it to the playoffs?
You know, 1,000%. I have a lot of faith in who my teammates are, on and off the court. We have a lot of hard workers. We have a lot of dangerous players on this team. Obviously, Bronco is a sensational player. He's the MVP of the league for a reason. Kevin's really come into himself as a basketball player on both sides of the floor. And the list goes on. Kang Ji-hoon's an exceptional player. Diaz has been an integral piece for us in the playoffs. And the list goes on. We have Kiki and Terminator being the head of the snakes on defense for us. And it's turned into, us just figuring it out. And us, you know, coming out being the team that plays the hardest on a night-to-night basis.
Well, that turnaround also happened in your very first season playing here in Korea. So I'm very curious how the league itself has looked from your perspective. You made your KBL debut this year, and before coming to Korea, you played in the United States. You also played in China. What was your impression of the KBL before coming to Korea? And has it changed after playing a season in the league?
Yeah, it definitely has changed. I have a few friends that played and are currently playing in the league right now. And, you know, from what I've heard, it is a extremely, extremely competitive league, sorry. And it's a different brand of basketball, if that makes sense. But, you know, as the longer I've been here, the more I've played here, it's basketball in one of its purest forms. It's really who's going to be the more cohesive team. It's really a 5-on-5 game here versus some other leagues. It's really just the team with the more talented players is going to win. But in this league, any team can be any team on any given night. It's just really all about who's playing better as a team than it is who's playing better as individual players.
What would you say are some of the biggest differences here in Korea compared to another Asian league like in China?
I think one of the biggest differences is, you know, the style of play. Korea is a very fast-paced league. A lot of teams love to play in transition here. They love to, you know, force turnovers and speed other teams up. And that's something that, you know, is a little bit different than in China. It really goes team to team, but as a league here, that seems to be like the overarching theme. It's getting out in transition, playing an exciting brand of basketball.
Well, of course, adjusting to a new league also means adjusting to a new country, new teammates, a different basketball culture. How did you find adapting to Korean basketball? Did you have any difficulties?
Yeah, I definitely did. In the earlier parts of the season, I definitely struggled trying to find my fit and where I can have the most impact on the court. And I'm a very emotional player, so I struggled with, you know, the way things were going for me in the beginning of the season. I struggled with, you know, the officiating, and I've tried to be better with that stuff.
And what about some of the most memorable moments you've had in the league so far?
Oof. That 10-game win streak was big for me as an individual, and I can only assume how big it was for the entire organization and all of my teammates as well. You know, just to see everything fall into place at the right time was one of those, you know, pinch me moments. You don't really, you know, think it's happening until you look back on it. It was a really good feeling to have.
And what about Korean culture and Korean fans? Have you noticed any differences there?
Oh, they're extremely passionate fans here, extremely positive fans too. And I can only speak for the fans that, you know, we have here in Sono, but they've stuck with us this entire season. All 60 games that we played so far, they never stopped showing up for us, even when things weren't going our way. Extremely passionate fans. And yeah, the culture, I've had no problem adjusting. I love everything about Korea, the people, the food especially. I love the Korean food here. So it's been an easy time adjusting.
Glad to hear you're enjoying it. And of course, such an exciting time for the fans. And another part of Goyang's playoff story that has drawn a lot of attention is, of course, the leadership behind the team. Head coach Son Chang-hwan has been praised for his very empathetic leadership during this really amazing run. Can you tell us, you know, from your perspective as a player, just what he's like as a coach and describe your experience with him? Are there any specific things that he expects from you as players?
Yeah, I mean, Coach is, you know, he's the epitome of a servant leader. He really understands us as players. And, you know, we're more than just basketball players. And he really has leaned into that. And, you know, it's allowed all of us, you know, be the best versions of ourselves. And as far as the things he expects from me, it's conversation that we've had on a daily basis. Is just I have to be able to be coached. And I have to be one of the leaders on this team. You know, as a cerebral player, I have to be able to, you know, think outside of myself, think outside of the box, and, you know, just be the best version of myself that I can be.
Well, now the focus, of course, shifts from celebrating, although brief, that semi-final win to, of course, preparing for the biggest stage of the season. What is your mindset going into the championship finals, which are set to begin on May 5th?
Just continue what we've been doing. Like, every game we've played so far hasn't been perfect, but it's been hard fought, and we've been able to, you know, come out unscathed. Going 6-0 in the first two rounds was, you know, the best thing that could have happened for us. We've been able to, you know, get some rest, you know, get our bearings back together. And yeah, the biggest thing is just, you know, going there swinging. Regardless of the team we play, they're all extremely good basketball players, extremely well-run organizations. So the biggest thing is to remember that and understand that going into the finals, and, you know, not be too high on ourselves. Obviously have confidence in yourself, but, you know, keep your head down and stay connected and stay together as a team.
Right. No need to fix it if it's not broken. Clearly, Goyang's doing something right to get this far. Finally, Mr. Knight, a word for the fans who've been with the team through this historic season. What would you like to say to Goyang fans, and what can they look forward to in the championship finals?
Yeah, the biggest thing I can say to our fans is thank you. They've shown up for us every game that we've played. They really have been the sixth man for us, bringing that passion and excitement. It's made it real easy for us to want to come out and play good basketball for them, not only for ourselves. And they can look forward to, you know, a good brand of basketball, a holistic brand of basketball. Like I said earlier, we have, you know, we have a ton of pieces that can, you know, be extremely dangerous on any given night. So they should just look forward to that. Look forward to an exciting brand of basketball.
Certainly lots to look forward to. Goyang's first playoff season has already been remarkable, and fans, as well as us, will be watching closely to see whether the team can carry that momentum all the way to the title. Nathan Knight, thank you so much for joining us today on Korea 24. Congratulations again on your team's historic run to the championship finals, and we wish you and Goyang the very best in the finals.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
It's time now for Movie Spotlight, your weekly ticket to the world of film, from the hottest blockbusters to hidden indie gems and everything in between. And this week, our critics Darcy Paquette and Jason Betrovese are doing something a little bit different. Darcy and Jason are in Udine, Italy, for the Udine Far East Film Festival that takes place between April 24th and May 2nd and screens films from across Asia. Hi, Darcy.
Hi, Alana.
Hi, Jason.
Hi, Alana.
Now, Darcy, you've been working for this film festival for many years. Can you start off by giving us a bit of information about its history?
Sure. The city of Udine is a small city in Italy, but they've long had a quite active film society. And back in 1988, they held this big retrospective on Hong Kong cinema. And the response was so electric that they decided, like, we have to do this every year. And so at that point, they started this Far East Film Festival. In the early years, they were focused mostly on Japan, Hong Kong, Korea. And in recent years, they've, you know, spread out a bit further. So it encompasses all of East Asia and Southeast Asia as well.
And Jason, you're there for the first time. What's it like for you?
It's amazing, Alana. It's, you kind of get the best of both worlds here. You, you get great films, and you also have some great food and wine. So, you're working, but it feels like you're on a holiday. The atmosphere is terrific. I love the audiences here. You know, they're really passionate. They're asking lots of questions, both young and old, you know, different demographics. You know, it's a really vibrant cinematic culture, and I think it's the perfect place for it. So, you know, it's just great to come here, even though, you know, I'm unfamiliar with a lot of the different aspects of the festival, because, you know, this is the first time I've been here on the ground, so to speak. It's a great place for discovering a new culture of, you know, viewing cinema. And I'm having a great time.
It sounds fantastic. I wonder, can we convince our producers to do a Korea 24 episode live from the festival next year?
Yes, come.
Well, let's get back to the films, of course, for now for a second. Jason, the festival invites Korean films every year. What films are screening there this year?
Yeah, really fabulous, interesting selection. And thank you, Darcy. You know, he's an invaluable member of the team there and in kind of selecting these titles. So we've got a range of different films. I mean, where do I start? You got some independent films. That includes Yoongun's The World of Love. I put down The World of Us, but it's actually The World of Love. You know, this is the latest film from her. Her titles, you know, focusing on children. And then you've got a movie by Chung Ji-young, one of the veterans of Korean cinema. You know, we've talked about these films on the show. His new film, My Name, that screened at Berlin Film Festival earlier on this year. We've got the melodrama, which I'm actually going to see again shortly here on the big screen. Kim Dae-young's Once We were there. So yeah, it was, you know, that's an interesting film. We've also got Kim Tae-young's Number One, Jang Ha-jun's The King's Warden, which was a successful, very successful film in Korea, amassing over 60 million admissions. I think it's the number of people watching the film, it's the second most viewed film ever in the Korean film industry. We have the documentary, The Seoul Guardians, directed by Kim Jong-un, Kim Shin-hwan, and Cho Jo-young. We've got Kim Dong's Mr. Kim Goes to the Cinema, so that's another documentary. We've got Kim Tae-young's Number One, and also we've got two older films as well. So Park Kwan-soo's Chil-soo and Man-soo from 1988, and Park Chul-soo's Push Push from the 1990s.
Now, Darcy, as we've just touched on, you've actually had a hand in the selection of all these films. As a consultant for the Korean programme, what do you and the festival look for when you're selecting these titles? Is there anything that, you know, makes the audience at Udine unique?
The interesting thing about film festivals is that each festival has its own particular kind of audience. And, you know, if we look at the Busan Film Festival, for example, you know, you have cinephiles and people who follow cinema really closely come from all over Korea down to Busan. And, you know, this is a festival that's really kind of rooted in its local city. So, you know, it's a quiet city. So every year this festival takes place and, you know, there's so much to see and so much to do. So a big part of the audience are just ordinary people who live in the city. And at the same time, if you're somebody who follows Asian cinema and you live in Europe, this is one of the best places to get to see new Asian films, you know, to listen to panels, and they have a lot of guests that fly over from Asia. So people travel from other parts of Europe to come to this festival. And then they also have kind of an industry section where you get producers and distributors coming in to do their own thing as well. So, you know, it's very dynamic, but the audience, they really get into these films. And, you know, seeing the response of the audience has been quite exciting. And since I've worked here for a while, I do kind of get a sense of which films are going to work at this film festival.
Well, speaking of audience responses, Jason, I want to ask you your experience as a member of the audience watching some of these films in Udine this year. What have been some of your highlights?
Yeah, there've been so many highlights, Alana, you know, having a terrific time here. But yeah, Chilsu and Mansu, like I've talked about this film so many times in my classes. It's such a such an important seminal film from the 1980s. But you know, I've never seen it on the big screen, so there was an opportunity here to watch the film in a cinema, and Darcy did a wonderful introduction. And so that was really special, watching that film with an audience. You know, that's something I've never done before. That was truly special. And then and the reaction as well to The World of Love. And because The World of Love, Yoon Ga-eun's first, this is the first film that I saw at the festival. It was truly amazing, like just seeing, you know, the audience stand up and clap. It has this kind of can like standing ovation culture, where the audience kind of, you know, give a big round of applause at the end of the film. And the film is so, so strong and so it just really does pull you in, and it's just such an impressive piece of filmmaking, and you know, tackling some very serious issues. And I think that film really did resonate, and you could just feel that in that just wonderful cinema that they have here. And then I watched the Seoul Guardians, and similarly, that's a film that's it's a documentary. It's looking at it focuses on the night when Yoon Suk-yeol instigated martial law. So that was in December 2024. And there were journalists on the ground, as we all know, filming it. And so this embassy put together this documentary, and it's just riveting. And you realise, you know, on that night that it so easily could have, you know, it could have been a very different story. Mm-hmm. And you know, watching Chilsu Mansu, which was a film from the 1980s, you know, this hugely significant moment in Korea's political and political history. And also the movie My Name. Sadly, I didn't see that film here in Udine. I watched it in Seoul, and I talked about it on the show. But, you know, I could see this kind of this theme of like history and the past and influencing the present. And you know, the My Name deals with the Jeju, you know, massacre from the 1940s and 1950s, and there also references to the 1980s, and watching, you know, Chilsu Mansu, and then also seeing what unfolded on that night in such a visceral way, you mm-hmm. know. So for me, just yeah, watching the films here has been really special.
Right, we often talk about watching films on the big screen versus, you know, at home on TV through streaming services. So I can imagine why seeing a movie like Chilsu and Mansu was so special on the big screen. Darcy, you've been busy not only helping select the Korean movies for this festival, but also moderating discussions and panels, along with joining the Korean talent to these screenings. And you've also just mentioned, you know, that you've been involved in this festival for many years. Is there anything in particular that has made this year special?
I mean, I always enjoy moderating these panels because you can hear in depth about, you know, filmmakers' thoughts, you know, behind the films that they made, and also their response to the screenings that we have here. This year was somewhat unusual because there's also another program called Coca on Screen, which is sponsored by the Korea Cultural Contents Agency. And they've arranged for some special additional screenings of some documentaries and some series as well, including the series Phantom Lawyer. So, you know, the star of that series, Yoo Yeon-suk, is here in Udine. And, you know, a huge crowd showed up. He's clearly very popular here in Italy as well. And, you know, being able to moderate that panel and then to kind of soak in some of the energy of his fandom, that was quite exciting.
Unfortunately, that's where we have to wrap up this week's Movie Spotlight. Big thanks to our movie critics joining us all the way from Udine in Italy. Thanks so much, Jason.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And thank Appreciate you, Darcy.
Oh, my pleasure.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24. But we'll be back next week with more of the stories shaping life here in Korea and beyond. Korea 24 is produced by Daria Kim, Yoon So-hyang and Kim Bum-soo. I've been your host, Alana Hill. Thank you for joining us. And until next time, take care and goodbye.